Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. A power trio of guests today. First, in moments, Raquel Varela will tell us about the new center-left government in Portugal, which is not as anti-austerity as it seems. Then Mark Oppenheimer will analyze the comfort culture at Yale University, whose luxurious campus has been the site of racial tensions over the last few weeks. And finally, Max Geller, spokesperson for the Renoir Sucks It Painting movement, explains why Renoir sucks and why it matters. First, Raquel Varela. She was on this show just 2 weeks ago to talk about the results of elections that had been held in Portugal on October 4th. A center-right alliance of two parties won 39% of the vote and almost half of the seats in Parliament. The center-left Socialist Party, which despite its name was the initial author of the post-crisis austerity program, won 32% of the vote and 37% of the seats. Unusually, though, a coalition of three left parties took 10% of the vote and 16% of its seats. After the election, whose results distressed creditors across Europe, the president asked the right-wing parties to form a government, despite having a minority in Parliament, but it was brought down the other day by a no-confidence vote on November 10th. A fresh coalition of the so-called socialists and the left parties have now put together a deal to form a new government. Here's Raquel Varela, who teaches labor history at New University of Lisbon, to tell us what it all means. The government lasted about 2 weeks before it's being replaced. What is going on?
Well, it was expected that this would happen because the right, the more right liberal governments, although they won the elections, they didn't got the majority of the votes of the parliament. So from the constitutionally, the majority of the deputies can elect a new prime minister and reject this one. And this is what has happened today. So the center, let's say center-right or center-left party, well, a third-way party, the Socialist Party, was joined by the Communist Party and the Left Bloc to turn out this government. And now they have made an agreement that the Socialist Party will govern with the support in the parliament of the Left Bloc and the Communist Party.
There was initially a plan to have a coalition between the socialists and the right, right? But that didn't stick?
No, by the contrary, which is a very interesting situation. So probably the Socialist Party, this center party, was afraid of a situation like the PASOK in Greece and turn a little bit to the left. When I'm saying a little bit is that the agreement is really a very short agreement, which is very, so it's very odd that the Communist Party and the Left Bloc do support this agreement because it has nothing concrete concerning jobs, doesn't give nothing to the people. What it makes is to make less cuts. So, and they will not allow the privatization of the transports. This is part of the agreement of transports in Lisbon and probably the TAP. And also they ask for the devolution slowly of part of the direct income, salaries and pensions that were cut, especially the lower ones, will be the first ones to be given back to people. But there is nothing concerning, for example, labor market or how to avoid migration. So Portugal has lost 500,000 workers in the last 5 years. There is no concrete measure against precarity, just a vague, we will fight precarianization, but, there is nothing about debt or renegotiation of the debt or the banks to give back the huge bailout, huge money they got from the Troika program. So there is no any guarantee that this, even the short measures will be effective. So it's a very, very small agreement.
Yeah, the American press was presenting this as something of a reversal of austerity, but that's really not the case.
No, not at all. Not at all. So the biggest measures concerning taxes, the cuts that were made in the last 5 years in the welfare state, in education, in the number of people working in the hospitals, etc., there is no clear preposition. There is a vague principles or intentions, but there is nothing like we will hire a number of doctors or nurses. There's nothing about this in the agreement.
But does this at least represent some sort of political opportunity that the forces of austerity are losing their dominant role, or is that too optimistic a way to view this?
I would say this is too optimistic, but that's also true that they are not as strong as they were before. So I think these elections have proved that people are really tired of these policies. So I think there are big divisions, let's say, if I'm allowed to say, between the dominant classes or the ones from above are not as strong and together as they were before. So there is a big struggle between the Liberal Party and the Center Socialist Party about who is going to be dominant in the state and in the state apparatus, because there is less money to divide between these fractions of the bourgeoisie or the dominant class or the powerful classes.
You're free to say bourgeoisie on this radio show.
No, because usually people connect bourgeoisie with something pamphletario or something like that. But the idea is that the bourgeoisie is who owns the means of production. That's so. And I think there is less agreement between them how to rule the state, how to divide the money. So I think this would be a major opportunity for the left and for the unions to fight back. But it's not being used like this. It's being used as a support to this government.
But when Syriza conceded on the memorandum, a lot of people thought, you know, that was the end of anti-austerity politics in Europe. Can we hold some hope that maybe it wasn't the end?
What we see both in Syriza and in this so-called left government, and it's not at all historically a left government, it's a center government. What we see is that the Troika measures are being applied, the debt is being paid, the huge amount of the money of the state, of the tax, of the workers, goes to pay interest of the debt. And this is not being touched. So it's very odd that we have left governments doing this, although they do, for example, a more stronger or less tough policy towards, for example, the poor working classes. So this new agreement has, let's say, the less cuts in the social assistance to the very, very poor people, as they have done in Greece as well. But we don't see any end of austerity measures. We don't see, for example, one of the things that is common in Greece and in Portugal, it's the high rate of unemployment that allows generalization of low salaries. People are absolutely exhausted and in burnout because of long-time working hours. So we have part of the society working in long, long, long working hours in very bad conditions with very low wages, and a huge amount of the society is simply unemployed. So this permanent army of reservoir, this surplus population is being used to cut the salaries of the, let's say, all the workers in the society, or at least almost all workers, except very high qualified work is not in this situation. And we don't see any changes of this, either in Greece or in Portugal. So I think the society, it's doing an experience with, let's say, a little bit less austerity governments that are not even reformist governments, because a classical reformist government would give something to the people. The classic reformist government would say, we are reducing 1 hour the time, the working time, or we are giving extra salary for holidays. This is a classical reformist government. So now the reformist government or the left government are governments who say we are cutting not all the pensions, but just 60% of the pensions. We do not cut the poorest one. So it's just the government who says we take less. It's not the government who says we give more.
Finally, when we spoke a couple of weeks ago, you were remarking on the fact that there was this electoral outcome, which was fairly favorable to the left, that happened in the absence of any kind of popular mobilization. Do you see any signs of that changing? Is there any kind of popular mobilization developing, or are the Portuguese people still somewhat disengaged?
There was one single demonstration against the government called by the main union attached with the Communist Party. And this demonstration, the unions were not asking for better wages, better living conditions, better working conditions, but they were giving support to the new government. So it's very strange, because even the unions, it's not strange if we know the history, but it's very strange even from a reformistic point of view to the unions, because this would be the perfect time for the unions to demand more, not to support the government, but to use this new government and to demand wages and working conditions. And we didn't see this.
Why do you suppose? Are they just so tied up with the ruling parties that they are not going to make up the fuss?
Yes, I think the answer is that, no doubt. We have unions absolutely attached to these political party strategies. So this will increase the union crisis. We have a huge deunionization, and if the workers see that the unions are much more willing to support an institutional way out than to demand workers' rights, this will bring, at the end, the crisis to the unions itself. So I think this is a very wrong tactic from their point of view.
That was Raquel Varela, a labor historian who teaches at New University of Lisbon. After a musical break, we'll hear about the undergraduate culture at Yale.
Nervous Charlie, far walks and near. My baby told me she will not drink with me. I have been informed she will not be warm. And in Lisbon it seems there was a car full of all of the nameless. Some of them shameless, and then there's Charlie, fireworks and beer. My baby told me she will not drink whiskey. It's that liquid flame does not appeal to her, and Lisbon it seems.
That was Some of Lisbon by Per Ubu. Next, Mark Oppenheimer. Yale, along with the University of Missouri, has attracted lots of attention lately because of racial tensions, always present, breaking out to open conflict. At Yale, there was an incident of a fraternity, the nationally notorious and not for good reasons SAE, reportedly turning away some black women from a party because they only wanted white ones. That, and a controversy over a memo from the diversity office urging students not to wear racist costumes at Halloween, which prompted a retort from another administrator who questioned the wisdom of such directives. In the subsequent conflict, both documents were caricatured. The diversity office's polite and reasonable suggestions were turned into a politically correct diktat by its critics, and the retort turned into a defense of the right to act like a bigoted jerk. I'm interested in this story not only because I went to Yale, class of 75, but also because I'm interested in studying the American ruling class, and Yale is a crucial institution in its reproduction. At many elite colleges these days, students are demanding trigger warnings. Warnings that class material might cause offense or distress. We talk some about those in this interview, assuming some knowledge of them among listeners, but that might be a misplaced assumption. Anyway, Mark Oppenheimer teaches writing at Yale and had a very interesting piece on the Tablet magazine website, tabletmag.com, on what the recent racial incidents say about the culture of Yale, where instead of confronting the offensive, students turn to the administration to make things right. Mark Oppenheimer. Welcome, Mark Oppenheimer. The controversy over the Halloween costumes at Yale certainly attracted a lot of attention, but you wrote a piece that looked at a somewhat different angle on this, which is the culture of Yale and the loco parentis model that seems to be taken to extremes there. So what is it about the Yale environment that led to this curious confrontation?
Sure. Well, Yale sells itself as the most nurturing of the Ivies. I think. They never use those words, but that's really what they're selling. The undergraduate residential life is organized into 12 what are called residential colleges, each one of which is presided over by a master and a master's spouse who's called an associate master. And the woman who wrote the letter about Halloween costumes that got so much attention is an associate master. She's married to the master of Silliman College. And the master and spouse are really the social directors. They're the mom and dads of the colleges. And so the point I wanted to make was that when she seemed to be taking sides in a controversy over political correctness of costumes or offensiveness of costumes, which is a real issue, she was perceived as taking sides with white students who might want the freedom to offend against black and brown and yellow students who would be offended. And what she, I think, didn't realize was that it would be perceived as mommy, because the master and master's spouse are mom and dad of the college, taking sides with some of the siblings against other siblings. So it's not some distant professor doing something. It's the person who lives in the college with the students, who has them over for tea and cookies, literally, during exam and midterm times, whom they go to when they are upset about something. It's a very nurturing role, and that means that all of this is much more fraught than if it were just a political debate.
It's funny, when I was at Yale, the master of Sabre College was Basil Duke Henning, the longest-serving master of any Yale master, who was reputed to be, as many other people are, one of the models for Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. But they just plied us with punch. It was not quite so nurturing 40, 45 years ago.
Although, what was in the punch?
Booze, of course.
Yeah, I mean, they do a lot of plying with punch, but they also are hired for their warmth, their hamishness, their willingness to love students. And you noticed, as I pointed out in my article in Tablet at tabletmag.com, that several of the students who were angry with the master said, you know, this is our home. Our home now feels unsafe. Two different students used the home metaphor. And so, in other words, they weren't saying our classroom's an unsafe space or our campuses. They were saying our home is, our living room is, our bedroom is, because the colleges are really fashioned as homes away from home. I remember when my parents dropped me off at college in 1992, I remember the master of Jonathan Edwards College, which was mine, saying to my mom and dad, we'll take good care of him. And he had this very lovely, elegant, grandmotherly wife who kind of nodded as well and patted them on the shoulder and said, "They're, you know, Mark's in good hands." And they were really handing me off to an aunt or an uncle or a grandma and grandpa.
Well, when I was looking at colleges, you know, in 1970, I remember reading about Yale. There was an intensely competitive environment, that even lunch was like a blood sport. Is that true anymore? Has that changed?
When was it like that?
In the 1970s.
Ooh, did you feel lunch there was a blood sport?
Well, you know, it was a lot of intellectual contention. Everyone wanted to be smarter and more knowledgeable than the next guy.
I don't think of Yale. I mean, look, I'm 41 and I graduated 20 years ago, but I've been teaching here. I've been a college student, a grad student, or a teacher here for almost my entire adult life. And I don't see it as a particularly competitive place. I think students are very supportive of each other. I don't think there's a lot of, you know, who got which grade on this, in part because due to grade inflation, they all got an A or an A-minus on everything. I think it's a fairly supportive environment. I think the pressure they put is largely on themselves. I think the pressure to be busy, to carry many extracurriculars in addition to a heavy course load, to get whatever brass ring they imagine is on the other side, largely comes from themselves and from their upbringing. I don't see it as something that they're putting on each other. I don't think they feel they're competing against one another. And I think in that way they're to be commended for that.
But this is also an institution that educates the sons and daughters of the American elite, or recruits the American elite, that will then go along, you know, that will graduate to staff positions in the American elite, which means often a very brutal thing. I mean, the CIA was practically founded at Yale. The culture that, you know, they have this kind of hothouse culture, but then they're going to go off into a world and be very brass-knuckled about it all. How do you make that transition?
I think to some extent that's changed. I think that, they are still people who get here because they were able to navigate, and negotiate adult approval. So they're still going to look for it after college. I think that what that constitutes is somewhat different now. It often constitutes, you know, jobs at consulting firms like McKinsey, or getting into very good law schools, or getting into Teach for America, which in some years has been the most popular destination of members of the senior class, which is perceived as a social justice, as a bit of social justice work. And so it's not the CIA or the military or necessarily the white shoe law firms to the same extent. What I will say is that I think there have been moments in Yale history. My father went to Yale and graduated in 1967, so people were graduating right into the draft, the Vietnam War draft. And there have been moments, I think his was one of them, when there's been a more of an anti-authoritarian spirit and more of a sense that it's okay to graduate with no plans and go find yourself for a little while, go kick about and, you know, be a Dharma bum or whatever. And I don't think we're in one of those moments. Students feel absolutely, they feel the necessity to have plans in mind for when they graduate. And when I tell them, I talk to them a lot about journalism, and when I say, look, there are no, you know, there is no path you can take that reliably will get you a job in journalism that begins 2 weeks after graduation, that freezes them up a lot.
Well, I recall Kingman Brewster, then president of Yale, wrote in the letter welcoming my class that Yale is no longer a role like bowling balls from Wall Street in New Haven to Wall Street in New York. So that was the countercultural moment of Kingman Brewster.
Right. And I think that's true to some extent. I don't think that there's a sense that they all want to be investment bankers. I think it's true in certain communities. I think that on some of the athletic teams, the coaches hook them up with alumni who are now working in banking or on Wall Street. I regret that what I see as a kind of questing intellectual spirit doesn't reach as many members of the Yale community as it might. There are parts of the community that are sequestered from it. And I think that, you know, if you took some of these kids and threw them into the grade-free build-your-own curriculum of Hampshire College or to a lesser extent Brown, that would do them a world of good. But I don't think that it's, you know, any stereotype that they're all headed for the CIA or Wall Street is pretty badly outdated.
Now, your piece in Tablet developed a point that a thought I had when I was first reading about this controversy, which was if some Yahoo from Deke is wearing a racist costume, why don't students confront him? Why turn to the administration? Why is that?
I think that, I mean, yeah, that was my main argument, which was if there's a belief, and it's, I don't know if it's true, but if there's a belief that the fraternity SAE had a party where one student, it may not have been every Deke member, but where one student said to some black women who wanted to get in, we're looking for white girls only tonight, that the protest should happen on the front steps of Deke, not necessarily in the heart of the Yale campus. Not that it can't happen in both places, and not that it doesn't speak to things that are possibly afoot in the larger culture, but the first place you have to confront is the student or the student community that's responsible for it. And I think they perceive that that's, you know, one person said to me, well, that would be dangerous, or, well, that would get too heated. You know, it's always safe to encircle the dean of the college as they did and talk or yell or plead or beg. You know, administrators will respect certain boundaries, and I think there's a fear that if students confront other students, that not that things would get violent, but that could get really painful. And they want an avoidance of pain. There's not a spirit of confrontation of one's peers. They're exceptionally nice to each other. It's very, very hard to get a good fight going in any class that you teach, and I think that's a problem.
Again, this is really a sharp contrast with what I remember. So what's happened? Where did this Pacific culture come from?
Well, I think, you know, we had a high water mark of contentiousness around the time when grown-ups were trying to send boys off to die in Vietnam. I think that one thing that happens when you have a wartime culture is that there's a real obvious questioning of authority, and people really naturally divide along certain lines. Right now, I would say there's no issue that's dividing Yalies that way. 95% of them are probably well-meaning, slightly left liberal Obama voters. They all believe in multiculturalism. It's a pretty homogeneous place in that way. And, you know, tolerance is the watchword, and that comes out of some well-meaning liberal, you know, efforts toward multiculturalism and political correctness. That, you know, what you don't ever want to do is make a person feel that they're bad. The self-esteem comes out of self-esteem culture as well. So all of these things, versions of parenting and versions of pedagogy, have all sort of confluenced, have all come together to say, like, above all else, validate each other and be nice to each other. So the kind of friction, the kind of fighting that comes apart if some students were to confront some other students and say, we think your fraternity is poisonous for us, is not part of their culture.
So this is all related to the celebrated controversies over safe spaces and trigger warnings, right?
Right. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Some of the students used the term safe space. And one student said, I don't want my college to be an intellectual space. I want it to be a safe space.
Yeah, that really stunned me. I mean, Yale is one of the most distinguished universities in the world. It is an intellectual space. Why? Well, how did they say this?
To be clear, that student was talking about her residential college, which is to say her dorm. And so I think they have a real bifurcation. They would say maybe in theory the classroom can be a place of intellectual debate, but when you leave and come home, you're supposed to be safe. I mean, again, this also goes to the extent that the faculty administrators have helped create this with our grade inflation, with our nurturing, with our refusal to treat them as adults. So, for example, one demand you heard yelled out at the dean in one of the videos was, we want dean's excuses after episodes of racial trauma. Now, let me unpack that. A dean's excuse is when you go to the dean of your residential college and get permission to turn in a paper late or to take an exam late. The dean's the only one who can grant that. The professor can't. What they were saying was, if I've been offended racially, I want permission to hand in a paper late. And that's not wrong in and of itself, but what they're saying is, in order to be freed up for some sort of activism or to discuss racial trauma, we need to be assured that we won't be marked down for a late paper. Right? Like if it sacrifices a 3.8 or 3.9 GPA, we're not sure that we can skip classes. So contrast that with students at, you know, Berkeley in 64 or Columbia at 68, who basically would take a semester off or fail all of their classes because the activism was more important. And that's just not there anymore.
Well, Yale in 71, people were walking out of classes over the Cambodia
bombing. Absolutely. Like a class strike is unthinkable.
I'm speaking with Mark Oppenheimer, who teaches at Yale and is a contributor to Tablet magazine on the web. So where does this come from? Why does the administration want to create such an environment and be so indulgent of students? Where's the old, you know, toughen them up and kick them in the butt kind of thinking?
Well, look, mass widespread college education only came after World War II. It came with the GI Bill, which was a good thing. Before that, it was an elite product that was in some ways insulated from the marketplace. Since then, you know, it has become a consumer product. I mean, we are pretty early in the evolution of widespread mass higher education, and it's catching up with us that, like everything else, that the masses get access to, which is good. I mean, the masses should have as much right to have an automobile or cable TV or a bachelor's degree as the elites, but like everything else, it eventually becomes a marketplace that is consumer-driven. So it's unthinkable now that you could have a campus that has dorms that are a little bit hard scrabble or that don't, you know, have fast, zippy Wi-Fi. This, by the way, happens at boarding schools as well. I went to a private school that was a boarding school. I was a day student, but they had dorms. And these days, you know, if Andover and Exeter didn't have really, really beautiful dorms, their prestige alone would not be enough to bring the students. The students want the newest squash courts, the best dorms, the greenest fields. And that's where higher education has gone. So what that's meant at a place like Yale is widespread grade inflation, a sense that it's harder to impose curricular demands on students, you know, more of an emphasis on their taking what they want rather than what the school might feel is good for them. I don't think that's a terrible thing. I think that, you know, distributional requirements or specified curricula don't often produce the effects that people want, and I think we have a notion that there was a golden age of super highly educated, classically minded Yale and Harvard alumni when, as you pointed out, a lot of them, you know, went into the CIA and presumably spent their retirement years reading Tom Clancy novels.
Or sound like George W. Bush.
Yeah, right, exactly. I mean, they weren't all intellectuals. I mean, the top 80 kids in Andover got into Yale every year in those days. You know, number 77 and 78 weren't the brightest bulbs. And so, but it's, you know, this college education is a consumer product now, and that means that it's harder to uphold certain values, be they, you know, ruthless honesty or candor or grading rigor or things like that.
Now, my friends who teach at CUNY, when they hear this safe space discourse, they say, well, you don't hear this kinds of things at Brooklyn College. This really is something for the very elite colleges, isn't it?
I think so. Of course, I only teach at an elite college, so I don't have the basis of comparison. But I will say that my sister, who teaches or is an administrator at a New York City community college and who is herself an intellectual and who reads, left-wing magazines as well as the New York Times and has friends who are intellectuals. When I asked her, what do you think of trigger warnings, this was about 6 months ago, she had never heard the term.
Okay.
Now, this is someone teaching, a left-wing intellectual teaching at a New York City community college, which tells you how much this is an elite college problem.
I was surprised, too, to learn of the proliferation of Greek life at Yale. When I was there, I think Deke was the only remaining fraternity, and people regarded it as kind of a zoo. Now, of course, that seems to have a much more prominent role. What is the role of Greeks at Yale?
Well, it's still fairly minimal if you look at numbers. I think there are, leaving aside ethnic fraternities, so I think there are two or three African-American fraternities, one Latino fraternity, and they play a different role in the culture, less of a partying role and more of a solidarity role and also networking role for alumni. But leaving those aside, I think there are the same – there were four or five fraternities when I was an undergraduate in the mid-90s and three sororities. I think each of those has inched up by one, so there may be six fraternities and four sororities. And not many people are members and not many people live in their houses. But their parties are extremely popular on weekends, in part because it's a place to drink off campus. And, of course, we have this absurdly low drinking age of 18, which puts the universities in loco parentis and scares kids about drinking in the dorms. So, but more interestingly, I think students feel that there are fewer social options. The notion that you would have a somewhat, countercultural little community of film buffs or, poets or, queer radical artists or whatever that would do their own thing, that would do their own partying on weekends. Those groups still exist, but those groups are smaller and more people feel more drawn to a kind of mainstream culture of big parties. And again, I'm not an undergraduate. I'm not the expert on this, but it seems that – let me put it this way. Note that the fraternity incident began because African American women felt discriminated against when they were trying to get into the same big beer bust that the white women were eager to get into. So, what you have is a situation which black girls as well as white girls all want to go get wasted and get hit on by the same athlete-heavy, white, preppy environment in an off-campus house. Now, there's a sense in which one could call that progress. But there's also a sense in which it's profoundly depressing. My analysis is that it's not that right now is not a time on campus or in American culture when we really value the eccentric as much. If you read some of Lewis Lapham's writings on being a bohemian Yalie in the 50s and how you didn't hang out on campus. You were looking to go to the cool films off campus or to take trains into New York City and explore culture. That was always marginal, but I think it was more of a community than it is now.
And finally, what's the consequence of this explosion been? What's the mood on campus like, and what are the paths of resolution that look to be in the offing?
Well, I'm optimistic. Some students told me it's all anyone's talking about, and that's great because I'm usually bemoaning how all students talk about are their grades or their Instagram feeds or sports. I'm usually bemoaning that there's absolutely zero student activism, and there still is very little around issues that transcend campus life. Although yesterday there was a good action around fossil fuels, and there has been some attention among students to the Black Lives Matter movement, but they're by and large very depoliticized. So I think it's great that they're all talking about it. And I also thought it was great if you looked at the latest rally. There was a 1,000-person-strong solidarity rally yesterday that apparently ended with because there were some musical groups performing, it ended with like a big dance party. And I think that speaks to the Yale spirit very well, that at the end of the day there was a lot of they danced it out, which I think is great. So I think that the opportunities for conversation are really exciting, and as I wrote, even seeing that horrible moment where the student was using profanity toward a professor, which is, if it were my daughter, I would have been upset with her, because I think swearing degrades discourse. And I also think it's fairly gendered. I think that, if it's a man swearing at a woman, we do rightfully see that as violent. And I think that swearing tends to privilege a certain kind of angry, macho debate. But that said, the fact that she felt free to confront her professor and to show that she was angry with her college master was in its way moving. And my whole point was, I do want these students to see themselves as adults, as grown-ups. Now, sometimes that will mean accepting a C+, because grown-ups accept criticism well. Sometimes it will mean taking it to the actual fraternity rather than asking administrators to do all the work. And sometimes it will mean yelling at administrators in the same immature way that grown-ups as peers sometimes yell at each other.
That was Mark Oppenheimer, who teaches writing at Yale and who's the author of a piece about racial conflict and the culture of Yale on the Tablet Magazine website, tabletmag.com. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program Behind the News. Son of Street Life by Roxy Music. Next, Max Geller. Geller and his comrades in the Renoir Sucks at Painting movement became almost overnight internet phenomena because of actions they've staged at museums across the country denouncing the paintings of Auguste Renoir. It was all covered as a joke, which is not, although it's nonetheless very funny. Here's Max Geller to tell us more.
Welcome, Max. So, Renoir sucks. This is a controversial position in some circles, so give us the brief against this canonical painter.
Well, briefly, the Renoir Sucks at Painting movement evaluates paintings by, wait for it, looking at them. And if you look at your standard average Renoir, what's universal about it are the sort of treacly brush strokes, the ill-defined limbs and eyes that look like they were colored in violently with black magic marker.
And this is probably not a mainstream opinion, so how do you account for his vast popularity on the walls of undergraduates around America?
Well, I would say that I can't really speak to what the kids are putting on their walls these days, but I will say that it does seem to implicate the institution of fine art museums and the role curators play in society. I think a lot of curators think that their job is to bring in museum guests rather than guard the high altar of art.
But Renoir is sanctified as a member of the canon, isn't he, by most high-domed art connoisseurs, or not?
I can't really speak to that. I think a lot of people point out that there is a strong current of art scholarship that agrees with the movement that Renoir sucks at painting. And I think the Atlantic magazine found someone dating back to the late 1800s saying this. But this current of scholarship notwithstanding, you go to your local fine art museum and there's an excellent chance that there will be a Renoir on the wall. And in some cases, many, many Renoirs. And so I would say that regardless of what the sort of high-domed canon says, this is a movement of lay people who, have just as much right to articulate a sense of beauty as someone with a fancy art degree.
And how large is your inner core of your movement now?
Well, I would say, 10,400 people.
How did this movement get started? Were you the catalyst for it, or were there?
Instagram would be the short answer, but I think I scratched a nerve. There's no other way to really put it. I think a lot of people sort of were amused and persuaded by our critiques and have begun to actively participate.
Were you surprised that this became something of a, you know, at least an internet phenomenon?
Absolutely. I mean, it's I would say that I'm not only surprised, I'm gratified. It's a proof of concept for me that if you pursue a joke to its logical extreme, eventually people will start paying attention.
I mean, this is pretty funny stuff, but you're also not joking, right?
No, I mean, Renoir does suck at painting. That's like, that is serious. But I think any time you elevate a fine art opinion to the level of political organizing, that's a good joke in and of itself.
No doubt some people accuse you of being an elitist because Renoir is very popular, and who are you to complain if it draws the crowds to museums?
I think the idea that this is an elitist movement is fundamentally misunderstanding both the movement and what it means to be an elite. We are merely gathering a counterweight to the canon. And I do believe that the canon has let us down thus far. I don't think it's a joke, or I'm not kidding when I complain about the overrepresentation of white male artists on the walls of museums. I think that is a serious problem. Renoir's sex at painting might be a funny way to address that problem, but it's a serious problem. And it is, you know, it doesn't really jive with my understanding of elitism to sort of say that we should be democratizing our notions of beauty.
So he's a beneficiary of the affirmative action for white men that has dominated society for many centuries.
I think so. I mean, it's hard to understand why else he would be taking up so much wall space within the museums. I mean, he could barely even grip a paintbrush.
Okay. Now, you also have a critique of the museum system, which you've alluded to. So talk about that. What's your problem with the way museums are run?
I mean, I just think that, what did you call it, the affirmative?
Affirmative action for white men?
Yeah, that's been a real problem. I mean, I think that's exactly what's going on here. I think there has been, for, you know, the canon was established by white men, and they've been enjoying a sort of privileged place in society ever since. And I think it would be naive and foolish to say that people who aren't white men haven't made masterpieces, but you wouldn't know it by walking through a museum.
Now, you also had a complaint about the Frick, particularly Henry Clay Frick, the man behind the name. What's that?
The Frick, for those who don't know, is a gallery in New York that houses the private collection of this guy, Frick. And if you didn't know anything about him, you'd just say, oh, that's nice that he opened up his house to the public to let them look at all his the paintings he's collected. But those paintings were acquired through means that I find disgusting. And I do see a sort of connection between treacle in general and the pacifying of people through donation of money to the art museum. I think Frick famously hired a private police force to murder unionists at one of his coal mines. But I don't think ultimately he's any different than the Koch brothers, who gave millions upon millions of dollars that were gleefully accepted by the powers that be at the Metropolitan Museum of Art for that new fountain and plaza. I mean, I think this has been a ongoing phenomena of rich people using the arts and philanthropy to distract the public from how they're making their money, how they go about getting that money in the first place. I think it's philanthropy is really just pacification, and the deadening treacle of Renoir facilitates that process by discouraging museum goers from thinking about anything at all.
Museums also contain art that is profound and complex and actually can be seen as destabilizing the established order. A lot of canonical art is that way, even though it's embraced by the likes of Bill Bennett as a cultural pacification. So is everything hanging in museums under suspicion?
I think we should not be afraid to question any art's value, and I think we should be excited about those of us who love art should be excited about these conversations. But for the most part, I would say that no, the canon gets it right often. I think a lot of people sort of assume that the Renoir Sex of Painting movement hates Impressionism or doesn't understand its ethos, but that's not true. I totally understand Impressionism, and I totally, totally love a lot of Impressionist art. But those, the ones that the paintings that I love were painted by people who know how to paint, which I would not, which leave Renoir out of that category.
And do you have anything against his son, the director?
No, only his last name. I think Jean Renoir. I think The Rules of the Game, that's an amazing movie. That's a I love that movie.
So what's your end game? What would you like to see happen? What would Renoir Sex of Painting's accomplishment be?
I think at the end of the day, it's about access and who has access to space within fine art museums. And I would love to see that space become more open to more people. I also would say that the sort of end game is that museums start removing Renoirs from its walls in favor of better paintings and more and paintings that more people can sort of relate to.
Some people have just received your activism and the whole Renoir Sucks at Painting movement as nothing but a joke. It uses jokes, but you're really serious, right?
Yeah, I think just because something is funny doesn't mean it's not serious, or something is, you know, something just because we deploy humor doesn't mean we're clowns.
That was Max Geller, spokesperson for the Renoir Sucks at Painting movement, explaining to us how the deadening treacle of Renoir stifles class consciousness. In the spirit of Geller's critique, let's have a poetry break. Amiri Baraka reading at Naropa in 1978.
This is called Against Bourgeois Art. War on the horizon. A ship with a bloody sail. Andy Young slips on his Chamberlain appeasement get-up he got from years listening to the CP hype Martin Luther King. Is there somebody here to record this? United States being thrown out the front door, the Russian bear charging through the back door. Carmichael suddenly, clearly an apologist for new style colonialism, telling us we can't fight in the United States, though centuries of our blood, centuries of our dead are buried here. Oceans of our blood have fertilized a black nation. Afro zone in the South. Is there someone here to get this down? Can I get a, like they say, witness? An eye that can see through this here? In Jimmy Carter's snake oil show, there is a room nobody talks about. A steel door, fumes seep underneath. Inside, blood and hair on the floor, bones stacked in the corner, photos of Goering and Goebbels and Joe McCarthy and Nixon in the nude, trying to put helmets on their pecker woods. Will somebody put this stuff out? You walk through a museum, all the colors of the spectrum right there, but not one image except of checks passing, Pollock dollar signs, de Kooning fortunes, Larry Rivers pots at the end of the rainbow. No people, no love, no heart and soul insides flowing out, no fighting in the street, no fires rip the sky, no children screaming death, no police, no state except it is the state bullshitting on the wall. No people struggle, just colors thrown by baby snooks are down and leaving unintellectual. No record of this place. As wild a motherfucking joint as America is, somebody should get this shit down. Otherwise, no one will believe it. Get it down. Get it on the record. Get the hate, the horror, the lies, the Rockefeller monsters eating corpses. Hey, bro. Say, hey, what it is, dude. Yeah. Do it, do it. Is you? Wow, loud. Duty Roo, baby, baby, baby. Carrying the radio on his shoulder. They eating corpses, coal mines, garment center, assembly lines, hot steaming steel poured through space. Not any of life is there. Hey, poet! Hey, poet! Hey, poet! You artist! He turns in the shadows, sucking a marble, dribbling Andy Warhol's lost nut. He is an artist. He is a Poe 8, a Poe 9, too. His work is about everything. His work is about the universe. Her work is about stars belching. Her work is about gray hair lost in the desert, peeped in a teeny voice. No babies, no screams, no red life, no future. Death peeped in a teeny, teeny voice. Stupidity dripped in a sultry voice. Bourgeois poets yodel nonsense about boring absence. They think up funny ways for letters to sit on the page. Concrete bullshit. Already dumb shit. They are safe as old toilet paper. Revolution sweeps the world, but bourgeois artists stare at crumbs of dust in the light. People struggle, change reality, but these dull imitation poets talk to us of fragmented nothingness. Like two-cell creatures trying to bebop. The world is heavier than they know. They do not know. They fight knowledge with abstraction and think they cool because they talk to themselves. They are full of shit like vultures snacking on an open grave. They uphold dying capitalism and give themselves airs. They think they shit profound and complex, but the people think it is as profound and complex as monkey farts. Now, meditate on that.
That was Imre Bracha reading it in Europa in 1978. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this Lead Belly singing a bit of It's a Bourgeois Town. Till next week, bye.
Home of the brave, land of the free. I don't want to be mistreated by no bourgeoisie, Lord, in a bourgeois town. It's a bourgeois town. I got the bourgeois blues, I'm gonna bend the knees all around.